Time is a funny thing. It's here, and it's gone. You never really know what it was. It just drifts away on you, floats through like so much data. Now the time's copywritten. You know, I think about it more. We used to take it so for granted, but what time is it? I can tell you that this is me. I know who I am. This is Independent Librarian Dynamics, Sean Kennedy VI. Broadcasting from sometime after now. You're hearing this in the past, and I'm hoping that you can stop the future. This is episode number 732.653.663.398.36.9. And by listening to this, you should be aware that you're violating your listener's license agreement. This is an unregulated broadcast, and unregulated knowledge is pornography. So you'll be violating your listener's license and may be prosecuted for it. As well, you're probably violating employment contracts. Or any expression permits that you have, and therefore are risking prosecution. It's the same laws you're breaking by owning books you break simply by standing in a room where you might hear this. But chances are you need to listen to this, especially if this is the first time you've heard it. In the pits and out here, we refer to the, when we lost time, we lost it at the POC, which is our little, you see there's pre-POC and post-POC knowledge. Pre-POC is knowledge where we have, know exactly when and where it happened, the infamous 9-1-1, World War II, things like that. And then there's post-POC, which is, privatization of the chronograph, POC. Post-POC, that knowledge becomes very, very sketchy. There's no real way to know who, what, when, and where. And if you actually broadcast time, like, for example, if you were to somehow put up clocks and let people know what time it is, you would be charged with temporal piracy. But we all do it. We all have our own sense of time. Time is here and it's gone. It's probably the number one reason why I never became a node monk. It was because of the time shift. See, the server monks, they don't experience time like you or I do because of the being online the way they are. It's different. For me to explain that to you, I suppose I should explain a little bit more on detail about the old server monks, how they see things. As you know, server monks are folks who are permanently online. They dedicate themselves, usually with a neural jack, plugs into the head, can go anywhere on the head, but they usually put it between the eyes, representing the third eye. And they hook straight into fiber, and away they go. See, when you're online, it's not as though it's tapping into your optic nerves. The first Aikido masks drop, you know, jacked into your optic nerve, but they don't do that anymore. Now go straight into your psyche. See, it's not like you're staring at a screen or anything. I'm getting ahead of myself. Let me give you some background on how this all came into being. It was during the time of the war. Of course, I can't give you a date on that because that's post-POC, but the wars, of course, were great for business. The megas were growing, and the subculture of the web was just rampant. Everyone was mad for an escape. When you work in the inner city in the code pits, or you're not part of the arcologies, but you're still on the outside. You're not on the fringe, so you're somewhere in between. And when you're there, that's a dangerous place. You can't go out, you can't advance up, you can't get away, so the only place you can go is in. You know, the fourth dimension. Go online. So, I mean, at that time, it's always been illegal. I mean, it was illegal after 2001, but, you know, the subcultures were growing up and whole communities were there. It was only natural that they created, before the interface was ever there, there was always communities. There's people who would gather in these script-filled rooms, chat rooms, and they'd talk, and you got a real presence of being in a room, a vibe, almost, just from staring at a screen. It was far more pure than, you know, an actual graphical interface. It's hard to describe. It was like a soul-fulfilling thing. So it was only a matter of time before they started to work with it and try to make that stronger. But nobody knew how. Virtual reality had been around for, well, years, since before the turn, but the realms of, you know, using it was always so labored. There was always the desire to be inside the machine, but nothing really caught on. It was too expensive or cumbersome, or the interface wasn't there. It just didn't work. And then, of course, technology marched on, and server will find a way. And it was through the nerve interface technology that it became a reality. It wasn't even computers at all, the desire for online that did it. It was synthetic eyes. They created a neural interface for prosthetic eyes. Big glass-looking things. The first one, first-generation stuff, was just cumbersome. It was like having a couple of cameras strapped to your head, but it was developed purely for blind people, so that it's hard to imagine being able to see and having never seen before. It'd be like awakening a sense you never had, which is a lot like what the Dread Men and the Server Monks have. But being as the folks who are blind, their eyes didn't work, so they had to get past the optical process, the broadcast of the picture. They had to get deeper into the neural interface. They had to feed it directly into the brain through the optic nerve. And this was when it took off. Because if you can feed directly into the optic nerve, it's not like you're seeing. It's like you're dreaming. And that's important. That's very, very important to remember, because a dream isn't affected by things like time. And this is when the first few experiments with this happens. It really took off. Military applications were there. You see, when you're feeding directly to the brain, you're not limited by, you know, time, because you're not, you know, having to see things through the eye. You just feed it directly to the brain. Some folks, when they have a dream, the dream only lasts, you know, 5 or 6 seconds. Yet on the inside the dream, you're there for like 5 or 6 hours. Some folks have 2 or 3 dreams a night that seems to last for days apiece, but each dream's only 5 seconds. That's how time shifts when you go inside. The difference is that what they found out is that although when you're on the inside, it seems to last for hours and hours, when you come out of it, when you quote-unquote wake up, the faster the dream came in real time, like if it was a 5-second dream that lasted for a day, you'd forget it in very little time. Retention was the problem. So the military started working with it, spending god-awful amounts of money trying to make it happen, working on different procedures, high-speed training to get people on the front lines. The war was raging, after all. You have to get trained soldiers to the front lines, otherwise they're not effective. You got to keep training to a minimum. That became a whole other privatization as well, training the military. Before the turn of the century, the army would do all of its own training. Now there was corporations who dedicated in training soldiers. The privatization of the modern soldier. This worked out well for the army because they could, well, spend all their resources on killing people versus training people. And the corporations weren't regulated. And they would, what was the term they used for it? Competition, or some benefits to do with competition, healthy competition. That's how they justified the whole thing. Meanwhile, these private corporations were doing the most immoral things imaginable to kids. The army would recruit, they'd hand them off to the private corps, and they'd get back a killing machine, and they didn't care how they were made. Popular way of training them was by using masks. A mask is just a term for an interface device. There's lots of different kinds of masks. There's an oral mask, which feeds you sounds. This can be useful for doing what they call crack-thump training, where you can identify how far someone away who's shooting at you is by the sound of the rifle fire. Muscular conditioning ones that would fit over the whole body and condition it at a rapid pace. This, of course, assisted with huge amounts of steroid and aggression drugs, would take a 130-pound weakling and turn him into a killing machine. In about a week. A lot of the times with the physical masks and the oral masks, you could use them in conjunction, so by the time he went through a week of that, day and night, constant shifting body manipulation and training through technology, he was surprising if they could even remember who they were, which worked out well. There's nothing worse than residual self-image getting in the way of perfectly good functioning soldiering. But I digress. The real champion of training was the ocular mask. And what this did would broadcast experiences like dreams into the mind of the recruit, so that you could take some child dome farmer from Iowa and in a matter of, one night, give him enough battlefield experience and give him nightmares for the rest of his life. The problem was retention. The faster you feed the knowledge in through the ocular mass, the quicker they forget it. But for 2 or 3 days afterwards, they would, they'd be quite experienced. To get by this, they slowed the rate. They had inhibitors they put on the ocular stream in order to slow down the pace. If you had 1 second of real time versus 1 second of web time, it was as though you experienced it in real life. Very time consuming, though. In 8 hours, you could only do 8 hours. What they found was better was that they would mix it with skills. They would have some skills they would teach one for one, and they'd have other skills that they teach 0.5 to 1, which means that for every 2 seconds of real time, it was 1 second of dream time. So they actually slowed it to slower than real time. This is where time becomes kind of shifting. And if you experience something at when they feed it in that way, they call it halftime. If you're fed something through an ocular mask at halftime, I mean, that'll be ingrained into you like it'd be like a second nature. And then it goes even deeper than that, slower than that, quarter time, and so on and so forth. But we're talking about a very, very expensive uninterrupted, deep process. I mean, if you think about it, a 3-hour lesson fed at quarter time would take 12 hours to experience, but you on the inside only feels like 3. I mean, it's a very, very expensive and time-consuming way to learn, but wow, do you ever learn. This, of course, is purely for military purposes. They probably could use it to educate and, you know, make better doctors and stuff, but that would throw the economics of the education industry into chaos. So, of course, that technology was patented and regulated, too. You can't learn too fast. That's kind of a bad thing. The ocular masks, of course, were the most popular of the technology. Knowledge is power, after all. They became known as Aikido masks. Aikido being the acronym for Accelerated Knowledge Interface Device Ocular. An Aikido mask was... The first ones, I gotta admit, they look kind of neat. They look like a... Just a flat chrome sports mask. When they had the first functioning design of it, thing, Army threw it out to bids. This was their way of doing things. Rather than having a company develop it that way, the company would be able to demand that the Army pays any price they want. So what they did was the military developed the knowledge and then just gave it away to, you know, these spinner factories, and they would bid on the cost for making the masks. It was cheaper that way than having companies use proprietary knowledge to make a buck. Then once they started making the masks, the companies doing the training would be able to purchase the masks from the factories who were making it at bid, and it all kept the costs very low. It was nice. It was a nice system. It was a nice way to do it. And this leads us to our famous couple. Well, infamous, I suppose. They're known in the underground, but they were the first ones who took it from a military weapon and brought it to the people. There's a woman named Sheba. She worked as a web slave designing software in one of the Megacorp's subcontracted code pits, and she was good. She was gifted with code, how the machine worked. It was not so much... Well, with code, when you do code, it's not about what you can make it do. It's about how you can make it do things effectively, how to use the power of the machine. I'm not a coder, but I've read enough about it and the theory behind it that I kind of have a grasp of it. But from what I understand, she was good. She was very good. Her boyfriend's name was Morris. And he was a guy who worked as a shipper at a spinner factory called Haptech. And this is... The spinner factories, of course, are where they would throw the bids out to make these devices like the Aikido mask, and Haptech would then, you know, put a bid, get the bid, and if they won the bid, then they would, you know, pay their assembly line slaves money to build these things, and they'd have the shippers running the droids to punt it all out into the street. You'd think that all this would be run by robots now, but bottom line is human life is cheaper than steel, so still makes sense to have slave wage. When the first contract came up for the Aikido masks, it was a race bid. A race bid is yet another way that the government determined to save some money. Bear in mind, this is early on in the war when the government was actually a viable option, but they lost a lot of that power. But at this time, they had some. What a race bid is that they would say whoever could get us 200,000 units first would get the contract to make the remainder. This implemented that technology faster, so they weren't waiting. So what they did was they handed out 4-month temporary fabrication permits for the technology, and Haptech was one of those companies. They almost made it too. They almost pulled it off. But they didn't. They didn't make it. They made over 100,000 units in over just over 4 days. But another company beat them to the punch. Was it a backdoor deal? You betcha. It always is. Haptech had their own backdoor deal, but I guess somebody was greasing somebody faster. It's not how fast you work, it's how high up the chain your backdoor dealing cohort is, I suppose. It was fairly standard practice. Haptech would take the 100,000 units and wait to throw them on the market as a bidding thing. They'd just flog them. They'd make money. I mean, it was pennies. The technology was cheap. Their labor was practically nothing, so they were going to make money regardless. Now, Morris worked as a shipper for Haptech, so he was in charge of these massive warehouses of gear and kit and different spin-off technology, and Haptech made everything from different motors to prosthetics gear to you name it was all there. But in his heart, he was a web junkie. I mean, he was one of the subculture. Sheba and him would spend many, many hours floating around the chat rooms. I mean, what else are they going to do? Be online, see their friends. Friends with voices and faces that were just rendered. Some people would say that that wasn't the truth, but it's true. It's a reality. It's a world. Makes more sense than religion. But when he heard about the Akito masks, he was, of course, really interested, as anyone would be. And he acquired a few from the crates. Wound up taking them back to his place. Now, he and Sheba lived in a fairly nice box. You know, they had pretty close to 1,500 square foot cubicle they lived in. I mean, they had a door. You know, they could actually seal themselves off. It wasn't an open living area. I mean, you know, they could afford it. They even had they had running water in the apartment, and they didn't have to share the toiletries. So, I mean, it was they were doing okay. Enough room to set up their helm chairs and be online. It was all right. When he brought it home, Sheba was, give you some background there. Sheba, you see, was working on this dynamically rendered interface. This was her coding project. She was one of, you know, the managers on it, which sounds impressive, but really didn't mean anything. Management is just a way of giving more responsibility for less money. But the interface she was creating was called Opus. And this thing is, as I understand it, this was an engine, a graphical interface engine that would, you know, incorporate data real time and use it to alter trade. It would be something that would run in the background and could alter advertising promotions in the real world as they happened accordingly. For example, let's say a company notices, because you've got to understand this is for the megas, and no company does one thing. They have like 15 different things. They would take down natural resources, and they would make furniture, and they would make cars and all this sort of thing. So this was an advertising interface, and what it would do would be, say, the program would watch the stocks and see that the natural resource stocks were beginning to fall. So the engine would activate, and then in the synthetic backgrounds produced in advertising, they would use environments in their ads that would, you know, encourage the purchase of natural stocks, natural wood floors, wood desks, wood tables, that kind of thing. And this, of course, with the megas, they have constant global advertising, so it would always, you know, it would have to be running and be all over the world, depending on the economy. There's all these variables that would go into it, but what you wind up getting is you get dynamically effective, created advertising that would be tailor-made to not only encourage spending, but encourage spending in the right areas, even for products that weren't the prime feature of the ad. It's amazing technology. This was especially helpful in it doesn't have to be for natural resources. It could be for any low market region, like if they had makeup sales or something like that was down, you know, the makeup on the rendered actors would go up. It would do all of this, of course, by drawing from a database of images that compiling the data and rendering the image would be appropriate. So that way you wouldn't find out like a dinner table in the background of a desert shot. It was intelligent enough to know that a dinner table goes inside of a living area. It was an amazing thing, you know, but it may change the house in the background to a log house. That's possible. You could see that kind of a thing. But as it happened, you see, when Morris brought the Akito mask home, her company had been taken over by another company called Nanite. And Nanite didn't have a use for Opus, so she got cut. I mean, no big surprise. Someone with her skill set, you know, you get picked up by slave pits anywhere. They have the customary 3 interviews to make it feel like you're actually gaining something with this employment. And then they tie you up with all the shark speak on legal talk and make you sign everything. And then they enslave you and whatever computer you happen to own for a measly pittance. Wasn't much, but it kept their cube, so I guess it wasn't so bad. But she'd just been laid off. She'd just been let go. So when he brought that Akito mask home, it was an amazing thing for her, because not only was this a tool, because the way she thought, since she was so good at all this stuff, she realized that this could be used as an interface, not just for a one-way medium, but for a two-way medium. I mean, an Akito mask, this thing has to interface with very, very sensitive neural implants. Very, very sensitive nerve responses. So that's got to be a two-way medium. Now, before she left, before Nanite took everything, like any good coder would, she took a complete copy of Opus. And that was the real start of it. They, of course, she had a fine selection of the free work stimulants that were handed out by these companies, so she had no shortage of time, plus being unemployed, but she had a vision for a program, something that would utilize this. He showed her the mast, explained how it works, and that was it for her. And 6 days later, with the help of the enhancement drugs, she was able to translate the Opus engine and utilize the hardware that existed within the Akito mask to make something new, to make a device, make the software, and make the drivers to use it. It's funny how the two of them, Sheba and Morris, by doing this, gave birth to a whole world. A whole world. Their first experience with it was powerful. They They put on the Aikido masks, and they were actually able to walk for the first time into the web and see it as a place and not a thing. This was not just a rendering. This wasn't an interface. You were there. It was a dream, but it wasn't a dream. It was amazing. They set it one for one and the inhibitors so they could keep the memory. And there it was. They had the interface. The two of them could see each other. It was fed. It was incredible. It was also highly, highly, highly illegal, using stolen hardware, stolen software, non-disclosure agreement jobs, violating every license ever known to build this. Well, the two of them could have been executed for it.
But when people create the most beautiful things known, whenever anyone creates anything beautiful, they're always met with hatred. Maybe it's part of our nature. Shiva herself was beautiful. She had cream skin, shaved head tight, large blue eyes. I'm going by her avatar. I've never seen the original Shiva, but an avatar is when you're in eyes, when you're utilizing the eyes, when you can see. That's the representation of the other person. That's what an avatar is. Because you're not actually in the web, yet you are. Shiva's avatar. There's renditions of her throughout the web now. Everyone knows Shiva and Morris. Morris isn't perhaps as renowned as Shiva, but I mean, the monks pay him homage too. But Shiva is, well, she may as well be the server mother. I mean, when you're online now, it's an incredible feeling. You with a ocular mask, you would strap it on, feel slightly claustrophobic for a moment, and then you'd fall asleep while waking up. It'd just be like, wham, and you're there. In an ultra, ultra realistic dream. The engine would, the eyes engine from Opus would create a standard from the data based on where you were. If you were at a site and it was within a certain section realm of the web on the optic cable, it would make it the same for everyone, so you could actually use your mind to remember where certain things were. To drift using flight, there were so many options on how to set things up. It's too much to go over right now. I mean, it's like trying to explain television to people who don't know how to read. You'll see it as it's developed. I don't want the future to come, but I do think that the eyes have it. I do think that this was a great, great thing. To develop it further, Shiva and Morris, they released it. They just to their few close friends. I mean, this was all highly illegal. It still is to this day. It's just that they can't stop it. It was just a ghost circulating dark whispered rooms and deep crypto borbs. They talked about it. And very quickly it turned into the rumor of some open source interface that was better than any drug on the street. It was. And it was free. All you had to do was get a copy and upload it. It was simple for Morris to go and acquire more of the Aikido masks. He sold them. Did he make money on it? Yeah, he made a few dollars, I suppose, but I mean, he wasn't selling them for what that kind of technology should be sold for. Well, it could be argued that it should be given away for free, but I guess he could have made more money, but he didn't. He just made enough to keep things going with Sheba not working. Haptech would never have known. That warehouse was so full of gear. I mean, who cares? It was just a few keystrokes away from never having even been existing. It was only 100,000 units. It was a matter of time. 10,000 units were out. 15,000 units were out. The community was just there. Growing every day. As the community grew, so did the technology. People brought so much information to the table. They saw this for the beauty that it was, the escape, the opening, the great opening to another realm. And they wanted to build on it. They wanted to be a part of it. So gradually, the interfaces became more and more serious, more subtle ways and more direct ways. Before the neural interface to isolate the body was put in, they would hang themselves on these wires, a support structure to simulate weightlessness. It was an amazing system. Monks don't need to utilize the hanging anymore. I mean, they just sensory deprivation is a built-in part of the version of eyes now. But before that happened, it was an amazing thing to see, you know, hung up on these cords to simulate weightlessness. It was amazing. It was beautiful in a spider way, I suppose. Of course, they didn't have the room, so they set up the first temple. The very, very first temple. And the real beauty of this is that no one really knows where that temple is. A few people have been to it on the web, but the location is unknown, even to me. As a librarian, I'm usually pretty privy to a lot of information, but I don't know where this temple is. The first one was built. The first temple of Cerberus, the very first one that was built, was this underground water reservoir, I think. I've heard it was a water reservoir, I heard it was a waste reservoir, I've heard it was everything from an abandoned mine shaft to a nuclear missile silo. We don't really know, but somebody knew a place where they could build it. So they did. They made a place where people could go and hook in, hook on. It was amazing that they could do this. It was just beautiful. After it was built, Sheba and Morris, well, Sheba was already doing eyes full time, and Morris was not far behind her. It turned into more than just a user interface. This was a movement now. It was growing larger every day. The temple was kept secret. Very few people knew about it. Most of the time it was left empty, except for those chosen few whose names are still not known. This is the deepest knowledge with the server monks. This is some dark, dark background. Nobody knows it. But we do know that Morris and Sheba were the first ones. So Morris was able to leave his job and dedicate most of his life to server, to eyes, to being online, and through spreading the knowledge of eyes, helping people see what was happening. But again, when everyone tries to help people or heal them, they're always met with violence. You see, there was the companies who didn't want that out. Nanite found out about eyes. I mean, it was only a matter of time when you start growing something that popular and that huge. It was something they could utilize. Technically, I suppose they had a right to. I mean, the software was theirs. But it changed so much. I mean, it was like saying that because I made a brick, does that mean all houses are mine? That's a different conversation. Nanite found out about the software. They saw more than just this being a violation. They saw a way to make money. They wanted to regulate it. They wanted to hand this out. What a brand new, wonderful interface. And after all, this software could be made legitimate. As it is right now, it's unsponsored software. And well, unsponsored software is unregulated knowledge. Unregulated knowledge is at best pornography. And at worst, corporate sedition. So they decided to make a move on it. The problem was, you see, was that it was open source. It was everywhere. They had to seize it. They had to get their hands on it. The best way to do that would be to get the most complete amount of knowledge at once. And since there's no way of knowing where the most complete version and the most amount of knowledge was kept, they had to get that information from people. And those people were Sheba and Morris. Of course, grabbing people and torturing information out of them with various drugs is highly illegal, but we're talking about corporations here. That kind of dirty tricks and black ops have been going on since the turn of the century. It was nothing to them. Requisition the order and it went out. They had to acquire. They had to acquire. As though it was a purchase. They had to acquire Sheba and Morris. Demand went out. They didn't know the location of the temple. That was not something they could find, but they knew. Well, I mean, you can't really exist by purchasing or even talking, interfacing with people on through the web or even utilizing any technology that exists, especially at that time with all the war. I mean, I think it was probably even more restricted than it is now, but maybe you go through any kind of transit system and bio face recognition and things like that, you're going to be found. And the famous ending of it all was, you see, it happened in a subway station. The subways were these public, well, you probably have subways, but we don't have them anymore. They're a public transit system, and so since it's public, it's all private now, but subway was actually a public transit system. Anyway, it happened in one of the subway stations. They were underground, the two of them. And there's varying versions of the story about what they were doing. Some people say they were giving away masks. Some people say they were just out doing errands. Who knows? But they were together when the team showed up. Dirty tricks teams are easy to tell. They're usually not so subtle. You know, black gear, face masks, tactical armor on, padding, usually soldiers. Members of the team themselves, I suppose, aren't especially evil beings, but it's what they do. They're killers. Their orders weren't to kill. It was to acquire. Morris was holding hands with Sheba, and they walked through a subway station, crowds of people moving back and forth on their ways to various jobs, what have you. As fate would have it, Morris saw them before the agents saw Morris, and he bolted. The train wasn't in the station, so he hit the tracks and began to run. Sheba in tow. They held hands as they ran down the subway tracks. The shouts of
corporate police slogans behind them as they heard the sounds of combat boots slamming against the rail. They ran and they ran and they ran down that corridor. They had a good lead, and they could move fast. Violation alarms were going off in the tunnels. There was no way they would have been able to outrun those soldiers, even with the lead. You can't outrun soldiers. It doesn't happen. But as fate would have it, in those tight, tight tubes, a train came, rocketing along at high speed. Morris and Sheba were able to duck into a hobble. Before they could, a shot rang out. The screaming of the train mixed with Sheba. She caught the round just above her hips, slightly to the side, tearing a fleshy chunk out of her. It was a deep wound, went right through her stomach, through part of her back, bleeding badly, intestinal damage. Morris held her as she screamed and screamed, trying to stop the bleeding. It was a deep wound. It was a fatal wound, and he knew it. And it was going to be a very long and painful death. The soldiers had a choice. They could either take the shot or seek cover. And as a soldier would, they took the shot. Then the train ground them into mush. After it passed, Sheba had passed out, which was a mercy for Morris. There was no time now. What was he to do? He couldn't take her to the hospital. She'd been easily ID'd, and the company would be there to pick her up. He'd been expecting something like this for some time. You can't create something as beautiful as eyes and then expect to be able to walk. He knew this would come. But he'd hoped that Sheba might be able to survive. He picked her up, and with blood running down his back, he ran. He ran down the tunnels. The subway tunnel eventually serviced, and with Sheba over his shoulder and blood running down his body, he ran as hard as he could. He had to get to the temple. He thought he'd be safe there, but there were things that he didn't know. You see, when corpses send out teams for retrieval, they usually are loaded with specific ammunition, what they call tracer rounds. It's a bullet that, when ripping through, leaves, well, nanites, microscopic machines that will broadcast location. She'd been shot. So the minute they went topside, they were on the grid. Nanite was watching them. Was watching wherever they went. And they knew that they would go to the temple. Where else could he go? He'd be an idiot to go to this, back to his cubicle. So it was a game of espionage. And although Morris was a good man and a visionary, he wasn't a soldier. So he did exactly what they thought they'd do. He headed straight for the temple. The temple was empty by the time he got there. He slid back the barrier doors, came inside and secured them. Wrapped some gauze around Sheba, tried to stop the bleeding as best he could, and his mind was tearing itself apart, trying to think of what to do. Couldn't go to the hospital. There's no way to call. All communications was monitored. It would give away their location and they'd be lost. He could give himself up. They could just go with Nanite, but they'd both be dead for sure, and everything they worked so hard to create would be lost. And then the door started to get hit. Through the viewing monitors, he could see it was Nanite outside, beating on the doors. Somehow they'd found him. We know now it was the tracers, but he had no way of knowing. It was all going to be lost, all the database, everything, all the knowledge, eyes. It was all going to become private. What he had worked so hard to create, what Sheba was going to give her life for, was going to be for nothing. The doors were strong. They would hold them back for a little while, but not long. 2-3 minutes tops, and then they'd be inside. But it wasn't supposed to be like this. It was never supposed to be like this. And then it struck him. What had he had to do? He knew what the answer was, and it was right in front of him. As fast as he could, he pulled Sheba and strung her up inside the weightless wires and brought her as high as he could from the floor of the temple. And there, limp, she dangled, 30 so feet off the ground. Then he hung himself beside her. Both of them with their Aikido masks on. Only he kept a long razor with him. The kind you use for shipping, opening boxes. And he took that same razor knife he'd used so many times before to open shipments. And he opened his arms and legs up so the blood would run down and splash on the floor. Bleeding, he reached over and cut away the gauze on Sheba, letting her wound open and her blood fall and splatter 30 feet below. And then he hit the button that turned on the masks. But before he climbed up, you see, he'd taken out the inhibitors, the regulators that stopped the speed. He was running straight fiber into his mind. And just as if something comes at 1 for 1, it's real time. 2 for 1, 2 seconds equals 1. Well, he was running unregulated straight bandwidth into his brain. And in those last few moments before that door was kicked down, those last few instants, some say they must have had 100, maybe even 200 years of dream time together, living their lives within the web. Their life, after that point, had become a dream. As their blood ran out, the doors were kicked in, and there was nothing to be seen. The data had been distributed. He'd had 100 years to do it. There was nothing for him to move at the speed of thought. So in those last few moments, they spent 2 lifetimes together. Time is a funny thing. Time is a very, very funny thing right now. Of course, Nanite learned the location of the temple, but having knowledge and keeping it is 2 different things. It wasn't long after that that when the rest of the community found out what had been done, Sheba and Morris were elevated to the status which they should be. And that knowledge was taken from Nanite. They had no right to it. And the secret of the temple's location was lost. The tomb of Morris and Sheba. Now the server monks, they keep modifying eyes. Keeps getting better, stronger, more pure. They will live hundreds of years now in both worlds. In our world, they live, maybe 50, but online, you can add another 200 years to that easy. Easy. And with the implementation of embedded electronics, some of them serve constantly. You can actually be inside of a node monk's head while being online. Do you imagine dreaming inside someone else's mind? That's what it's like. It's incredible, the draw that's there for it. Technology is like a river. It surges forwards. Time, although it is powerful, has no mastery over that technology. Sheba and Morris taught me that. So to you in the past who I'm talking to, rather than try to stop this, which you can't stop this from coming, you can only guide the stream. Guide the stream so that this technology is held by us, held by you, held by people. You need to hold on to technology. Technology is the physical manifestation of man's will. It's the use and implementation of technology that makes us sentient, that makes us alive. You need to hold on to that. I should keep moving. This is Independent Librarian Dynamic, Sean Kennedy VI, broadcasting to you in the past from sometime after now. Remember what I've told you here today. Remember this. The future is coming very quickly. You can't stop it. But you can use technology to master it. In doing this, like with Sheba and Morris, you'll be able to fight back, to stop some of the horrors from occurring, to stop mine now from coming into being. Please. Please help me.